Welcome to the SureCast, a podcast produced by Bernstein Sure, covering a variety of law, public affairs, and community-related issues of interest. The opinions expressed are not necessarily those of the firm, and no advice in this podcast should be considered legal advice. If you are in need of legal counseling, please call Bernstein Sure at 207-774-1200. Thank you, and on with the show.
And joining us here today in the SureCast studios is Ari Solotoff. He is an associate with Bernstein Sure, and he has a very interesting background leading up to, prior to being a lawyer, and now has a very robust practice at Bernstein Sure. And I just want to welcome you first, Ari, to the podcast.
Well, thanks, Tori. It's great to be here.
I've been wanting to have you on this podcast for a while because of your background. It's so intriguing to me. First, let's let people know what it is that you do here at Bernstein Sure. I know it's a wide variety and a very creative cast of characters who you are representing.
Yeah, I consider myself an entertainment and intellectual property attorney here at Bernstein Sure with a particular focus on copyright, because to me, copyright drives so much of what happens in the creative industry. And so I work with clients, particularly the talent side, the artists, the creators, those who bring innovations and interesting concepts to life to help them think through, protect, monetize, and earn money from their work.
Which is really, really important, because we've seen and we've heard in the news different cases in which people didn't protect themselves well enough. And, you know, potentially there was a bunch of money that could have been coming to them, but they didn't have the protection in place to protect like what they do, their art, as well as what they had made off of that. I'm thinking about, and I think I can say this, Taylor Swift had gone through something like this.
Yeah, there are a lot of recent cases of potential copyright infringement where individuals who are in the news or who are popular artists are the target of potential copyright infringement cases. And that's just a great example of where there is money flowing in the entertainment and creative industry. There's also likely to be a wave of lawsuits behind that particular individual from those who are trying to profit off of their success. And so the interesting thing is that those who, even whether they have taken the steps to protect their work, may still be subject to and have to confront and deal with copyright issues, even if they've done everything right. And that's the real fascinating part, I think, of copyright.
Mm. And though an artistic city, Portland is, and Maine in general, draws a lot of artists here, I would only imagine that your list of clients stretches way beyond the borders of Maine.
Yeah, I work with clients as far as Los Angeles to Nashville to New York to Pennsylvania to Maine. That's the beauty of copyright and creativity, is that it really has no geographic limits. And copyright being federal law allows me to work with clients outside of the state, but also those who are here. And really the core of my client base is here in Maine. And I really enjoy working with many creative individuals who are bringing life to our state and bringing intrigue and popularity and recognition to all the cool things happening in Maine.
Does it work for you? Is it really word of mouth? And do artists, you know, really share the information of Ari Solotoff and what he can do for another artist? Is that how it works for you?
Well, one of the things that's worked well here at Bernstein Sure is I've been able to develop a niche practice in copyright and entertainment, and the word is starting to get out that we do this work and that we have this local expertise and capacity to provide market-level information, market-level knowledge here on a local basis. And what do I mean by that? It means understanding what rights are being optioned for, what are the market terms for influencer agreements, for movie rights option deals in literary publications, you know, what are the terms for publishing, music publishing arrangements and recording agreements. You know, so much of the legal side is both the business and the legal. And so understanding what the business terms are is also part and parcel to then translating that into a legal document. So I make it a practice to try to stay familiar with what's happening in current trends in music and film and TV. And as a result, I try to bring that value to the clients that I work with. And then hopefully they pass on the good work to their colleagues around town and in the state to say, if this is something that you need assistance with, here's who to talk to.
It seems like it's a wide open field right now. And in the past, you'd have people cutting albums and it would be all about that one album. But now things morph into, if there is a movie deal, then you know there's going to also be a record deal with it and probably a book and et cetera. I mean, it kind of blows wide open. Can you give us kind of an example? Obviously without naming names, but I mean, has it been really exciting on that front for you? And tell me one, maybe share a surprise, you know, somebody who you've represented and it's really gotten big.
Well, it's there's a spectrum. And what's great about where we are now is that there's incredible capacity for what I would call just the DIY artist. So an artist can literally take control of his or her output, her production, and get it out to the market using social media and all the customary marketing tools that are now available at our disposal, build an audience literally nationally and sometimes internationally, and as a result, benefit from monetizing their work. So what it means is, you know, we have this incredible capacity for local artists to reach a national stage. So for example, what amazes me is when a local, let's say, gamer might come in and say, you know, believe it or not, I'm working with Epic Games on a Fortnite deal. And you're like, here in Maine? And the answer is, yeah, here in Maine. There are people who are doing that work. And it just shows the reach of the esports industry, for example, connecting to, 15-year-olds here in our state, just like every other state. Mm-hmm. It could be, an individual who's producing a documentary film, produces the film locally and gets it out to all the customary streaming platforms that we have.
It's funny that you say the documentary piece. And I think, of course, I'm thinking more of the traditional disbursement of documentaries, such as like even, you know, locally, even, I mean, like PBS and all of that. But I mean, it really, you do go through hoops because there are so many different players who are involved in the making of, let's just say, for instance, a documentary.
Right. Yeah.
Many levels, right?
Well, you still need a filmmaker and a producer and capital to be able to make the film. The question is, how do you get it out to audiences? And what's changed is, instead of having to wait for, you know, a buyer to come along and purchase your movie or PBS to pick it up as a documentary film or to get featured in a film festival, you actually can produce the movie and have it out on Amazon or Apple or Google Play or Amazon Prime on your own. And so the walls of getting your content out there have relatively come down, and those barriers don't exist in the same way that they used to. Now, the downside of that, of course, is that there's an incredible proliferation of content out there. And so we don't necessarily, as consumers, have the ability to distinguish between all that content. And that makes for a greater challenge when it comes to the platforms being able to attract and maintain their subscriber base.
So you help, it sounds like, with quality control too, then.
Yeah, a lot of working with creatives is weighing in on, where I see the market going. And, nine times, or actually I should say, in every instance that I work with a creative client, it's important to me to hear their music, to read their literary work, to see their drawings, to see their comic book art, to watch the film, to watch the TV show that they're producing. Because if I don't have an appreciation of what they're creating, how can I convey that to the people that I'm working with? So that's a non-negotiable for me. And it's also the fun part of the job, that I get to be a consumer of this content and a consumer of all this incredible creative work, in addition to representing their interests.
That sounds hugely unique, I have to say, because I would imagine not every attorney does this.
Well, I think, we talk a lot about knowing your client's business especially here at Bernstein Shore. And I think that that's part and parcel to knowing your client's business. And whether you're a construction attorney or an environmental attorney or an energy attorney, you know, you want to know what your client is focused on from a business perspective, what drives them, what their key goals and milestones and you know, what's going to drive their economic model. And then as a result, you can translate that into the business and legal terms. I mean, you know, right now I'm working through a well-known composer who is negotiating terms with some very high profile symphony orchestras in, you know, international territories. And, you know, knowing and having heard this composer's work, I know the value of her work. And I also know the value of what the presenter is offering to her in terms of TV broadcast rights and radio broadcast rights and premiere dates, you know, with regard to her work. And so I'm definitely balancing all of that in, you know, negotiating with these presenters, but also, you know, helping my client to retain the value of their work, because, you know, this is an example of, she's going to actually have to create the work in response to this particular commission.
And you have confidence that she will be able to fulfill that.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, part of that just comes from, you know, knowing who the clients are and what obstacles they've had to overcome in the past, and having a sense of, you know, have they been successful at meeting their goals and delivery deadlines? And then that gives me the confidence to represent that to the third party.
So we were just talking about the kind of unique nature of Ari Solotoff. What also is hugely unique is your non-traditional approach to law, and yet you weave together something that's so important, and you just mentioned it, symphonies. And so I want to talk a little bit about what brought you to law. Your background was so fascinating, and share with people your background with, was it the Philadelphia Symphony Orchestra?
Yeah, so I worked for about 10 years in classical music. I focused and worked entirely on the management and administrative side of running symphony orchestras. And that meant understanding, you know, how do you take, you know, basically a production that is just a concept in a conductor's mind and actually bring it to life in a performance that hopefully results in a standing ovation. And there's a lot of steps that happen in between those two things. and there's a lot of time, and there's a lot of conversation and negotiation and money and also just understanding audience and, you know, who's going to come, who's going to care about this particular program. And so I started out doing that work in Pensacola, Florida, where I was the executive director of the Pensacola Symphony Orchestra. In the panhandle. And so that was an experience of marketing classical music to, you know, largely a Navy community. One in five people in the panhandle is employed by the Navy or the military.
And probably a lot of country music lovers.
A lot of country music lovers, just a different part of the country. And, you know, how we relate and make classical music relevant to them. You know, we might have Beethoven blue jeans, you know, as a way of introducing Beethoven to the community. Or we might have a stained glass series because it's a largely religious community. So, you know, it was always thinking about, you know, what does it take to invite people into music in a way that would be meaningful to them? But also, what does it mean to employ a symphony orchestra and a group of musicians who devote their professional careers to developing a skill and expertise in their profession? And actually, it's not that different from being a lawyer. I've come to appreciate, you know, 100 musicians on stage is actually a lot like 100 lawyers in a law firm in terms of their skills, talents, expertise, opinions, perspectives, and then collectively what they bring to the table.
Mm-hmm. So and each is necessary to bring about the harmony and bring the music, to bring the Beethoven.
Hopefully. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it all fits together.
So what is your background? Are you a musician?
I grew up in New York. I played the piano. I played the oboe. I played in symphony orchestras growing up. That really instilled in me for a love of classical music and music generally. And I've always just, you know, brought that to my work. I can't imagine doing work that didn't involve music in some way. And so, yeah, that's what carried me through from, you know, Pensacola to the Louisville Orchestra, then here to Portland, Maine. I ran the Portland, Maine Symphony Orchestra, and then I was number two at the Philadelphia Orchestra before going to law school and then joining Bernstein Shore.
Busy man.
Feels like a lot.
Yeah, it does. When you where did you study and what did you study in undergrad?
I went to the University of California, Berkeley. I actually majored in classical languages, so Latin and Greek. And believe it or not, it was just something that I did because it allowed me to do music. I had done classics in Latin and Greek in high school, and so I thought, oh, you know, I'll major in these subjects in college and I won't have to work as hard.
And there's a certain cadence to those languages.
They have a meter. Mm-hmm. They particularly Greek is a musical language, and a lot of the poetry that we, you know, Homer and others, you know, they definitely are known for that particular cadence and really for being, I think, the root of, you know, Western civilization when it comes to culture and philosophy.
I'm curious, what music do you listen to at home? And do you have, I keep thinking Amadeus has got to be your favorite movie. Maybe there are others.
I've seen Amadeus. I'm an omnivore when it comes to musical tastes. Mm-hmm. My tastes have evolved with my law practice, and not surprisingly. So because I represent hip hop musicians and pop musicians and film composers and country music artists and popular bands, jazz musicians. I really, you know, I listen to everything. If you were to look at the saved stations on my Sirius XM car, you'd find a wide variety. I even have a fair number of 1950s, 1960s, 1970s stations because I think the roots of contemporary music culture were driven by the music of the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
Mm-hmm. You've got to be wide open to all. I mean, just as you represent so many different diverse people from diverse places. Are you seeing a growing list of clients from Maine? And are any surprising or do you secretly root for Mainers to make it big?
I do secretly root for Mainers to make it big. In fact, I feel like I'm on a little bit of a secret drive to help Mainers make it big. I'm very involved with the American Bar Association's Sports and Entertainment Law Forum, which is our national division for entertainment law. And this year I was involved in the planning committee and I made it a point to try to feature Maine speakers as part of this national conference because I felt like there would be value in a national audience seeing the, you know, talent, creativity, and really wonderful people that are coming from our state. I also know, having traveled to quite a bit to Los Angeles, that folks in LA have a certain authentic mystical appreciation for those who are in Maine. Mm-hmm. Whenever I introduce myself as being from Maine, you see their eyes light up and they have this look in their eyes of like, wow, you know, you live in Maine and you're, you know, working in entertainment law. Like, that's,
you're real.
Yeah.
You're a real person.
Right. Yeah. I see your bean boots and, you know, did you eat lobster last week? That's, you know, usually the line. And then you moves on to, oh, well, my son or daughter, you know, went to Bowdoin College or Colby or Bates, or I visited Bar Harbor. There's almost always a point of connection to our state. And so even when I'm in New York or LA or Nashville, people are trying to find a way to connect to Maine.
Yeah. Many of them went to summer camp here, I think.
Oh, yeah. They either went to summer camp here, have a camp here. It's a very, I think, unique place to be able to situate myself in doing this work.
Is your area of expertise in law growing? And do you see, you know, I know that you've got quite a few clients, and are you growing your area and trying to maybe train up some more lawyers to help you out in your area?
This area is growing. I'm working really hard to keep up with that growth, and I think that there is definitely opportunity to grow. You know, the ability to meet the growing needs of creatives in Maine, and to market that capacity in a way that those who are here don't have to look outside of the state to find the expertise that they need. It's actually, I'd say, one in three transactions, you know, with a Mainer, a Maine creative, that I find, you know, a lawyer in doing the work from, you know, Virginia or Nashville or LA, even though the creative is, you know, or a musician or whomever is based here in Maine. Mm. So I think we still have some work to do to get the word out that we have the capacity and the ability to meet their needs and to do it in hopefully an efficient and an authentic way.
I have to say, I think you have the coolest practice. I would love, if I were a lawyer, I think I would love to be doing what you're doing, because it is such great outreach to creative people, and you know the steps they've got to take. I mean, you've been there on so many different levels just with your background that I, you know, if I were an artist, I would have such confidence in you because of your background. You know what you're talking about. You've been there.
Yeah, you know, I literally got an email today from a student at the New England Conservatory saying, I'm interested in copyright law, and can you help me find the path to do what you do? And it happens, you know, fairly frequently that question comes up. So I'd say anybody who's interested in joining me and us, you know, in this work, I'm all ears, and, you know, would love to help steward that capacity here, because there's no question that if we can increase the overall awareness of how this work happens, it will lift the rising tide in terms of all boats rising with that rising tide. And what I'm finding is that the willingness to engage in the conversations that need to happen to help artists protect their rights is still in a very nascent stage here. There's still kind of a reticence to actually, you know, say, you know, that's yours, that's your content, that's your intellectual property, I'm willing to pay for that. I still think we have some work to do to create knowledge in our own market about how to work with this particular side of intellectual property.
I will say, and this is, I don't mean to lump artists together, but I would say the vast majority would probably agree that they're not the greatest business people, because they are, I mean, you know, I love writing. Am I a great business person? No. I mean, so if I had some books that I'd like to get published, and you sometimes you just don't know exactly the right path to go down. And to have somebody in your corner who's really going to kind of take it all the way up, it's just got to be incredibly comforting to them. And really important. I mean, because you can't, you know, you're not, if you've got, you could be the greatest composer in the world, but unless you protect it, I mean, somebody could come in and just steal it. And that does happen, I guess.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right, Tori. I think, you know, one is recognizing that if you know that your talents are best spent in the studio or writing or composing or, you know, making the art, being comfortable saying, I don't need to be the business manager. It's okay for me to farm that out and to find someone who I can work with who can be the business manager. And that's probably the biggest mistake that I see is, you know, creatives trying to do both functions, and it ends up not helping them, you know, in either direction. And so when you can get to that point of being able to employ a business manager to help you with the business side, you know, then someone like me who can be an advocate and, you know, help protect one's rights in terms of intellectual property really starts to make sense. And I talk a lot about building the team, and how when you're working as an artist, it's important to know who your team is. They don't all have to be on the payroll, but you have to know who your team is. And then, you know, as a lawyer, I'm able to plug in and really advocate. The other side of that is, and I wouldn't underestimate the value of just artists doing their own due diligence. And a lot of times, an artist will come. It could be a musician who's, you know, suddenly got their first synchronization deal or their first potential record agreement. And, you know, I'll say to them, well, you know, have you gotten to know who the person is who's offered you this deal? You know, before we even look at the writing on the page, you know, who is it that is on the other side? Who, you know, are they going to be your champion? Are they going to, you know, be your advocate? Are they, do you respect how they do business? What is their online presence like? Do your due diligence, because that will tell you a lot about how they will work with you. And if you're not comfortable with how they hold themselves out to the public, then odds are this is a deal you should pass.
And I think people probably additionally should listen to their guts on this too, because I think there are, you know, you can kind of get that sense, can't you? And kind of that, oh, that person might just be a shyster and want to just really kind of make money off my back here.
Unfortunately, that tends to be the case. I would hate to see someone spend money on legal fees when they didn't need to be, you know, getting into that arrangement in the first place. But I think that comes from undervaluing the art that you do produce, and not being specific about, you know, who are the parties and where do you see your music or art or film or whatnot going. Having some clear goals in mind for who your audience is kind of makes it easy to let go of those opportunities when they come your way.
And it sounds like they have a great, not just an ally, but you're almost like a guidance counselor, it sounds, because it sounds like you do help direct people and say, I could, maybe, are you a visionary? Do you help them kind of envision where they should be?
Yeah, we in the very beginning of my work with a new client, before we even get into discussion about whatever the deal is that may be on the table or the contract that needs to be reviewed, we just spend time talking about what are your goals as an artist? What's your vision for your work as an artist? Where do you see yourself taking your art or music or film production or design agency or influencer brand? Just having a conversation about vision is probably the single most important conversation that we have, particularly at the beginning, because then that really guides so much of the work that we do from that point.
I know you've helped a lot of people, and I don't want to put you on the spot here, but I do want to ask you, what's the greatest compliment you've received?
Well, I think... It's almost a shared message of you know, thank you for giving me the confidence, me the artist, to have the difficult conversations that I wasn't comfortable having myself, and for representing me in ensuring that I knew what I was doing, to me, that's the value. Even if we don't change anything on the page, I've really valued when clients have said, you know, you helped me understand what was happening here. And to me, if we can create understanding, then I feel like we've accomplished the goal.
It's a powerful feeling. You don't just work with individual artists. You also work with businesses and business leaders. Tell me about that.
Well, businesses, I think, are beginning to see the value of music in what they do and what they offer. And the really interesting thing about what's happening right now in the music industry is, A, it's growing. So it's projected to grow to something like $30 billion annually in the U.S. In the next about 11 years, which is pretty remarkable. From where it was a number of years ago when people were declaring the death of the music industry. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, because businesses see the value of music in retaining customers and drawing customers in, it means that they need help understanding how to navigate music licensing. And music licensing is a complete labyrinth. Could not have designed a more complicated system in understanding and managing music rights, not just here in the US, but globally. So one of the things that I actually enjoy the most about my job is helping businesses who are exploring how to use music see the path forward and understand who the right parties are to speak with and how to go about acquiring the rights and licenses that they need to use music, whether they be a brewery who's trying to attract more customers to their brew room based on live music performances, or startups who are trying to use music as a key part or strategic part of their growth. And, you know, the music industry is looking beyond the general customer base, the general Spotify and Apple user, to businesses, to those who are working in healthcare, who are working in music tech, to continue to support the growth of the music industry. And I think we're uniquely situated here in Maine to not only understand what's happening, but to support those businesses that are trying to use music to their strategic advantage.
All right, you just piqued my curiosity here. Healthcare, so is it using it to reach people who are unreachable, like dementia patients? Is that what we're talking?
Yeah, so there's increasing studies showing that there are positive short-term and long-term benefits of connecting with music in rehabilitative settings. And as a result, because we identify with music so quickly, music can be a mechanism for actually engaging brain function. And so we've seen, you know, lots of books. Music Ecstasy in the Brain is one example. Oliver Sacks has written a number of books about the relationship between music and neurology and neuroscience. But now, finally, technology is catching up to the point where we can actually see that link between music, technology, and health benefits. And I think that's probably one of the most exciting frontiers.
I've seen it personally with my now deceased mother-in-law. And it absolutely just completely connected her. I mean, she knew every word of the song. She couldn't talk, but she knew the words to the song. It's amazing.
Right. It's unbelievable because it's both tangible, physical, somatic, and also in some ways independent of our present cognitive brain function. It's something that's going on viscerally, and that's what makes music special, and I think that's where the opportunity is going forward.
You'll continue doing what you're doing. You don't have any interest in going in any other direction?
No, there's plenty of work to do here for sure. And I think, it's really interesting. I refer to copyright as giving a creator, giving an author 6 superpowers. And they get those superpowers in the moment that they create their particular creation. Well, the beauty of creativity is that it's one of these almost unlimited resources. It's not like, you know, land or, energy resources like coal or oil, where there's a finite supply. And so, you know, as I look out ahead and I think about, you know, where's the potential, it's around creative expression and supporting that creative expression to animate people around the world. And, from a legal standpoint, that means that we have a lot of good work to do.
Do you think every child should be required to take a musical instrument, or at the very least, learn how to hold a paintbrush and really delve into the arts? I mean, this is not a political statement, but I'm just wondering, I'm curious where your stand is on that.
Oh, for sure. I mean, last Friday was National STEAM Day. So science, technology, and education and the arts. And so now arts are part of the STEM education. And I think it should be remain an essential part of that education because it, you know, creativity, sparking the creative approach to looking at problem solving, and just sparking creativity in general, I think is just a way of being seen And when we see each other and each other's creativity, we feel validated. We feel like we have something special to offer the world. And to me, that's what art is capable of inspiring in young people.
Makes for far more interesting people as well. So before we end, let's let people know how they can reach you, your phone number, your email address.
Yeah, I'm available by phone. I pick up my phone.
Wow.
My direct line here at Bernstein is 207-228-7146. My email, my first initial, asolotoff@bernsteinshure.com. And I'm on Instagram at Ari Solotoff.
Ari Solotoff, it sure has been a pleasure to sit down and talk with you. And you are a fascinating individual. And I love the work you're doing. And I just wish you all the success.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Tori.
Thank you for listening to The Surecast, a Bernstein Shore podcast. We hope you have enjoyed the program. To find out more information about the topics discussed in this episode and more, please visit www.bernsteinshore.com/media. Thank you.